instead of, because sometimes you can feel like you've got to go with a trend, you know, and you've got to follow the trend and what everybody else is doing, you've got to do, because that's going to get you from A to B. And I would just suggest stick with the path that you are on, the one that you think you're going to enjoy, because I don't think anyone wants to play music they don't enjoy. So go on your path and ignore, you know, when you're playing for other people, other artists and whatever, okay, be versatile and whatever else it is. But I think it's important to know where you want your journey to take you.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians worldwide, with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. This week's guest is the British guitarist Edison Herbert, who plays melodic and soulful groove-based music that will lift your mood. We are featuring his compositions from a couple of his albums, and you'll learn about his personal journey in music that has led to his career as a full-time performer. He talked to me about some of his mentors and influences, including George Benson, and his perspectives as a Black artist navigating the music scene in the UK. I found him to be warmly engaging and candid, and we circled around to topics that impact all of us, such as dealing with self-knowledge, creativity, and the need to be persistent and keep true to what's important to us. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. Did you know that this podcast is in season 4 and that I send out a weekly email newsletter where you can get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests and be inspired by highlights from the archive? Have a look at the description of this episode where you'll find all the links. Speaking to such a diversity of people shines a light on the persistence required to attain mastery in any field. I try to constantly improve every aspect of this podcast since I take care of all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. I really do need the help of my listeners to keep this project going. Please consider buying me a coffee through my support page, which is linked to PayPal. Thanks so much. And now to the episode.
Hey, thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So I love your music, and it's so nice to have this really feel-good music. And I'm curious if we could start maybe with your journey in music, because you started doing classical piano, right? Like a lot of jazz musicians.
That's right. I grew up in a musical family, two brothers that also play. And I had church musicians. That's my first introduction to music. And from there, started playing around with instruments. You know, there was always an instrument in the house, or there was a piano or whatever, and so I just started dabbling with it. And eventually my mom and dad sort of thought, okay, we're gonna send all three of them to learn to play the piano. So we had a music teacher come around to the house, and she used to teach us piano. So that's where it began. And then we'd practice and play, you know, the tunes that we were taught. And my mum would sit beside us by the piano, and every time we kind of made a mistake, she'd say, go back and do it again. And that's where it all began. So the discipline of practice came from there, I think.
So in terms of guitar, you were self-taught at the beginning.
Yeah,
anyway.
For the most part, self-taught. I mean, I have had a few teachers here and there, but for the most part, I just listened to records and watched people's hands and listened and did my best to figure things out from wherever I could. Books, but back then videos weren't. I'm showing my age now. There weren't so many, you know, video tutorials and all that sort of stuff. So we mainly used books and records. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
And you were playing with like gospel choirs growing up, or as you developed as a guitarist, that must have influenced your music.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, mainly piano work, really, playing with got small okay. gospel bands, choirs. And then later on, use the guitar as part of a bigger band situation with choirs and other gospel situations as well.
So I was hoping we could share a couple tracks from your albums, which I love. And I think you have a new album you just recorded that'll be coming out soon as well.
I have a new one that will be coming out probably March, kind of end of March, that kind of time, maybe slightly later. Yeah. Yeah. And it's different to the previous one as well. So some interesting things happening.
Well, how is it going to be different?
This album is more of a kind of more straight ahead, but also still got the catchy element to it, where I've got a couple of pop tunes and arrangements of pop tunes, which I really, really like. I like to mix and match and make it accessible for people so that they can, you know, you don't have to be a jazz person to hear it, you know, that sort of thing. So, and also I've also got an American vocalist who sings on one of the tracks. So we've got Cherie Scott that will be singing one of the tracks on the album. A very special.
Yeah. You've collaborated with her before, right?
I have, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is she living in London or?
No, actually, many years back, I did some theatre performances in the States. Mm-hmm. And Cherie was involved as a singer in a few of the productions. So we did a few performances in the States and in Bermuda as well.
Okay. Mm. Well, before we get into more of that, it'd be great to play a track. Mm. And I was wondering if you had any videos that you've already put out there, but we could include just so, because some viewers really prefer the video version of this podcast, if they could see.
Yeah, I've got some videos on. They're already on YouTube, but I can send them over to you.
On your album, Time for Love, I Want to Wake Up With You has such a great groove. Would mm-hmm. that be okay if we?
Yeah, that's a great tune. Yeah. Yeah, one of my favorites.
If you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, this video you're about to hear will be linked in the show notes to Edison's YouTube channel.
One, two, three, four.
This was recorded at King's Place, London, and this performance features Sean Hargreaves on piano and keys, Neville Malcolm on bass, Pete Adam Hill on drums, Ian Lewinson on rhythm guitar, and Edison Herbert on lead guitar.
Okay, and you know, speaking of musical theater and shows, you were Ranger Music Director for Unforgettable. That was a tribute to Nat King Cole, right?
That's right. Unforgettable was first featured another American artist who was in the UK called Clark Peters. He was actually one of the writers of the show. And we kind of performed it throughout the UK, did a West End, and then and another American artist called Monroe Kent took over. So I came over to the States and we set it up over there and did a hell of a lot of traveling. And I didn't realize the place could be so big.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing show that shows the life of Nat King Cole. And it just really explains that what a special musician he really was.
I think he was the first black performer to star in his own TV show.
That's probably right, yes. Amazing piano player.
So do you have any stories from that tour?
Oh, I think my first experiences were turning up in New York and it being so cold, yeah. You know, because it is cold over here, but it's that much colder in the States when it gets cold. We basically rehearsed in New York and then we just traveled and ended up Route 66 and all over the place. And I saw so much and, you know, experienced so much just being in the country and meeting people and seeing things. Mm-hmm. And the good thing is you've got theatres everywhere, you know, in schools and everything. So you've got, you know, there's so much scope for theatre performers to practice their art, which I think is amazing.
You feel it's less so in the UK?
Oh, definitely, yes. We, you know, in schools and, you know, it's the quality of theatre as well, you know, where you can put professional performances on. You know, you've got them in America, they've got them in schools and, you know, it's just accessible. So you can tour and you can perform in all of these different areas where the UK we don't really have, you know, not that kind of setup.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's good for the arts because there's so much, you know, so much opportunity to find a location and perform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm a Canadian, and a lot of Canadians, if they want to have a touring career, they have to go to the States because Canada, we're just too spread out. We don't have the population. But right. There's red tape for a Canadian performer to work in the States. You have to, you know, get approval and all that.
Okay.
Not always so easy for musicians, right? Just to play anywhere.
Yes. I think we've got the same thing over here now with with the separation between Europe and the UK.
Yeah.
So, you know, the traveling's a bit more difficult and you've got the red tape is all set out. So, you know, you've got to find a way to make it work.
Yeah. Mm. I was curious because you'd got some funding from the Arts Council and I was curious if it was a little bit like in Canada, we have the Canada Council that gives touring grants and recording grants. Is it similar setup over there?
I'm not sure what you've got in Canada, but what we do here sometimes is an artist can apply to the Arts Council and put forward a project. And basically, obviously you've got to lay out exactly what you want to do, you know, all the criteria, you know, all the, you know, the audience you want to reach, you know, how many performances you want to do, the usual things. And you just have to put it all down on a form. It's quite detailed, so it takes a while to put it all together. And then you just submit your application and you see what comes back. And if you fail, you put it back in again. or you change something and, you know, hopefully, you know, it's accepted. So that's what I did for the Time for Love project. And initially it was just going to be a tour. It wasn't going to be a recording.
Okay.
And then COVID took place. So it was a matter of either the project stops until everything opens up, or I make use of the time. And I had to change my application slightly and say, look, you know, COVID's here and I'm going to keep going. And so I'm, you know, suggesting I do a recording, and I use some of this time to, you know, put it together, do the arrangements and all the rest of it. And that's what I did. And they accepted it. So I put that together. And then just as COVID came out of COVID, we went to the studio, and it was recorded. All of it's recorded live. We had a great time in the studio with some amazing British musicians.
Yeah. So you have people you like to work with all the time?
That's a luxury, really, because the people you want to work with all the time, they normally get busy. So I've got a nucleus of people that I work with, and if one's busy, then I go to plan B. So, and not necessarily meaning plan B, but someone else who will, you know, take on the role. So I, up and down the country as well, because obviously, you know, it's like you play in one area, and it's like you've got to make it cost effective as well. So I've got quite a few musicians I use in the north of England. And then when I'm down south, it's a different set. And that's how I make it work.
So you're from Leeds. Do you go up north to perform pretty often because you have like a network there? Or how does that work for you?
I'm from Leeds, which is in the north. Yeah. And so I've got a nucleus of people I work with up there. Prior to that, I was based in London. So that's the south. So I had quite a few musicians that I work with there. So between the two, we kind of make it work. And now I'm working on the Midlands. So I'll have a nucleus in the Midlands as well. So depending on where I am, there'll always be a kind of regular nucleus of people that I work with.
Yeah. Now you do quite a bit of teaching, right?
Not so much now. I used to. But okay. Incidentally, I actually trained as a primary school teacher at one point. So I kind of used that at times to, you know, with the teaching I do, if I teach kids or whatever. But I've got a few students that I'm working with at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
But I've kind of cut it down to focus on the performance side of things.
Yeah. But during COVID, was that you were able to do more teaching or teach online? How did that work for you?
To be honest, during COVID, I didn't do that much teaching. What I actually did was I used the time to pick up on some other skills which are just useful to musicians, you know. So it was like sorting out the website, you know, making sure it was okay. Although I had someone who did things with it. It's the you got to update things. You got to, you know, keep things current. So, you know, I spent a lot of time learning to do all the things that I neglected and always relied on someone else to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And music production. You do some production?
Oh yes, I actually enjoy being in the studio environment. I've been an avid like Pro Tools user for many years. And I, all of my own productions, I do the mixing. I also do quite a bit of writing. So it's everyone does it slightly differently. There are times when I write and finish whole production on my own using whatever technology is available to me. And there are other times when my mindset, the frame of mind is saying, you know, I don't want to do everything on my own. And, you know, you want to do it another way and use musicians, you know, to play their part and their role, as opposed to, you know, doing it yourself, you know. And there's two sides to everything. And I think both are equally as important and useful. And you use it, I tend to use them at different times for different reasons and different things. Mm-hmm. So, but the interaction side of things with other musicians is what I enjoy most.
Yeah.
It's just really nice to feed off other people, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas when you work alone, sometimes, you know, you have to have an extra coffee or something to get going. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're a vocalist as well. I think you sing a couple tracks. which one was I thinking about? Oh yeah, is she? Is she not? Are you the lead vocals on that?
You know, I was going to be the lead vocalist on it, and I actually did the guide and everything, and you know, but one of my friends thought he wanted to. My approach to my music is quite loose and open, and I'm kind of open to ideas, so I'm willing to try things. And so basically I did put down a lead vocal on it, and one of my friends was saying, oh, I'd like to have a go, you know. So we went in the studio, we did our thing, and I actually preferred his to mine. So a friend of mine, Richard McCoy, is his vocal, and I'm doing backing vocals on it as well. So yeah.
Now you're going to hear an excerpt from Is She, Is She Not? On the album Time for Love.
Morning comes, he has to rise. Long day ahead of him. Another day, another dollar. On that journey where he has to do some labor, he wonders, will things get much better? As he gets into his stride, a familiar face is over yonder. He smiles and continues on his way. Questions on his mind.
Will she, will she not?
Those are the questions on his mind. So many questions on his mind. Oh, so sharp, but oh, so late. Perspiration on his face. Boss man taps his watch and beckons to him. At this moment, all he can think of.
We could talk about George Benson. He's a mentor and an influence. Can you talk about how you met him?
Yeah, George Benson. I actually did a show called Guitar Star on Sky Arts, and originally what happened was a friend of mine said, you know, there's a competition and George Benson's going to be one of the mentors. And I'm not really into competition when it comes to music, because I think everyone brings something to the table. So I actually thought about it, and it was like, it was probably the last hour where applications were going to close. I thought, okay, I'll meet George Benson if I can do this. So I thought, okay. So I put something together and sent it in. And then they basically called me in, had a quick interview, played a couple of tunes for them. And they asked if I'd like to go on the show. So I said, okay, that'd be great. So on the first performance, George was sitting, all the mentors were just sitting on the, you know, in the panel, and just not so far away from you as well. So got on the stage, I sat down, and I looked up, and there was George with his thumbs up, you know. And I was like, okay. So that was an interesting moment, because you really, you know, I've listened to George for so many years, you know. Probably got every album he's done, whatever, and it's like, okay, he's here, and it's, you know, he's actually going to be listening to me play. So you got to straighten up, and you've got to kind of try and ignore the fact that he's there to get through it. So played, I think the song I played was It Could Happen to You, a really popular jazz standard. And when I'd finished, and I was just packing up, putting everything away. It was Tony Conte. I think George must have asked Tony Conte to come down and asked me to come and see him, you know. So I was like, oh. So I walked over. We sat down and had a really good conversation about... We just talked about all sorts of things, and it was a natural kind of conversation, and we were just talking about albums, just what we were doing, what tunes we like, just all kinds of stuff. And he just whispered in my ear, you know, just give me a call later on. I'm at such and such hotel, and we just got talking, and ever since then we've kept the connection. So, and we, since then we've had some really, yeah, really nice moments, you know.
When you're on the States on tour, had you met him at that point?
There's a few times where I know we played Arizona, and I know he lives in Arizona. He one of the bass players that we used actually knew him, and he actually called him and was chatting, but we weren't sure. He just got off a plane after doing a gig somewhere, so we weren't sure if he was going to come down or not. But on that occasion, he didn't, so I didn't get to meet him then. It's just he's so positive, you know. Really, really positive and really encouraging, you know, and he's always interested in what you're doing.
So, it's wonderful to hear. Is there a favorite album of his that you think people should hear if they're not familiar with his music?
He's an interesting artist because he's been through quite a few different genres or time frames or whatever, you know, even just jazz-wise as well. There's a great album we did with Jimmy Smith where he plays a couple of tunes on it. Things like Mimosa. He's got some great tracks that he plays on that. I think it was Mash. They play the tune Mash. And there's a few other tunes. But The World is a Ghetto, that was the album that got me. You know, he had, I think it's The World is a Ghetto. There's quite a few tunes on that album. I can picture it, and I used to sit in the car with a few friends of mine, and we're rewinding the track "The World Is a Ghetto," you know, because it's just a great version, you know. So, but he's got so many different albums with, they've all got a different sound, you know. Some are a little bit more modern, some a little bit older sounding, some organ trio stuff, whatever it is. So he's got it all. So there's, I think you just have to go to the best stuff first of all.
Yeah.
And see which era you might like best. Mm.
It's interesting now because of streaming that there's so much available. But I think for especially young people, they might not know of older artists, or it's just too much available, you know.
Yes.
But growing up, you had fewer options. There's like the radio or getting some cassettes. Were there like other artists you listened to a lot that really influenced you?
There's so many great artists. For a while, I just listened to a lot of guitarists. You know, there's all sorts. There's, you know, so many different guys. Grant Green, Wes Montgomery were two of my, you know, the three of them, you know, George Benson, Wes Montgomery, Grant Green, were my favorite options, mainly because they really, in my opinion, they really knew how to connect with an audience. And their choice of repertoire was always, it was accessible, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's quite easy to forget, you know, that you can increase your audience if you think about what you put in front of them, you know, because everyone, it's like food, everyone doesn't eat the same thing. So if you mix it up and, you know, put different ingredients in, then you're more likely to increase your audience.
I was wondering if you wanted to include something like your first album, My Favorite Tunes, Volume 1. I was wondering if you're going to keep that title with more volumes. But Love's in Need of Love Today. I really like that tune. Would that be cool to include that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The next tune is Love's in Need of Love Today from Edison's first album, My Favorite Tunes. Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, In addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
I was wondering if you might be willing to speak to, you know, the African diaspora in terms of being like a Black musician in the UK and your connection with, you know, other Black music.
Okay, do you mean in terms of the work situation, or do you mean in terms of playing the music?
No, my question about Black music, I was curious because on your website, I think you say I play jazz, funk, soul, maybe something else, and Black music. And I thought, what does he mean by that? And then I was kind of looking it up, and it was like music of the Black diaspora includes, you know, the Caribbean and African music. And I thought, oh yeah, that makes sense. But then, of course, all those other genres, you know, ultimately came from Africa too, jazz and soul.
Yes. I mean, when I guess the term Black music just basically, yeah, anything that came from Caribbean, Africa, wherever, you know, those were all my influences, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, my influences come from wherever as well. So, you know, it's, yeah, I guess I just try and, I think what I'm trying to say is that I like to mix and match, have good ingredients so that I can mix it all up. And, you know, you might not like this, but someone else will like that, you know, so that, you know, people can appreciate and step in and out of it. So they, you know, because it's very difficult to, if people are not used to hearing jazz, a lot of people just it goes above their heads, and unless you give them something to latch onto, you know, you lose an audience that you could possibly, you know, pick up a lot by the way. I think as a Black artist in the UK, let's say, for example, I think a lot of us grow up playing by ear, for example, and we don't all take the time to read music as such, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just different, you know. So I think one of the things I learned when I went to college, for example, when I did a year at music college, was that that was an integral part of being a well-rounded musician in I guess simply because it opens up a few other options to you. So I think that's one of the areas where I guess for the most part gospel musicians we tend to not really need to read. It's all mainly ear-based, and in order to work in other environments, say theatre and, you know, big bands and stuff like that, I think you need you need to be able to read it to a point. So you've got the ability to blend in and work in those situations. So I think simply being put in those situations has given me an insight into what's necessary in order to help make a living, you know. So I've been able to perform in theatre, quite a few shows. I was recently in, it was a Get Up Stand Up, that was a Bob Marley musical. Without reading, it would have been impossible to do it. So it's just certain skills you naturally work with your ear, naturally fall back on that because that's where you're from. However, there's other skills that you can incorporate, which can, I guess, just give you a few more opportunities, you know. In terms of working, I think on the jazz circuit anyway, there are, I would say, less people of color working in that genre. I think it's, I don't know really why it is. I think maybe it's just one of those things, but we are constantly having to try and push boundaries to get into different venues, etc., etc., the usual kind of thing. So I think we just have to be the best we can be and just keep pushing forward, really. It's the, whatever the world is we live in, we've got to make the most of it. So that's kind of my approach to working as a musician, you know? Yeah.
Have you had racist incidents where it's been really obvious in terms of getting work?
In terms of getting work and the whole situation, it's never totally blatant or obvious, you know. It's I guess the usual comment I'm used to hearing is, we're trying to, you know, you're asking for a gig somewhere, you've played there a few years ago, and you're thinking, okay, it'd be nice to, you know, go and work at that club again. And the usual thing I hear is, we're trying to diversify and change up the program, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, if you haven't been there for a few years, then you're bringing back something that's different by the time you get back there anyway. So, you know, but we have to work around it, you know, and that's all you can do.
Yeah. So were your ancestors coming from the Caribbean to the UK? I was kind of curious about that.
Yeah, that's correct. My parents, both of my parents, are from a very small island called Nevis, St. Kitts Nevis. And my dad was a passionate book reader who wanted to give us every possible opportunity in life. And so he made sure that we all could play, not necessarily because he wanted us to be musicians or anything like that. It was more of giving us the opportunity to explore.
Yeah, you mentioned at the beginning your siblings played, so was there some jamming happening in your family, like just music making?
I think we're all totally different personalities, so one's a total classical musician, so we're all at different ends, and one's got no concentration, so that just frustrating to we didn't really jam, but occasionally we'd play the odd piece in church and make it work, you know? Yeah.
Well, your playing is very melodic, and although it's like groove-based, there's improv in there, but it's more, I feel like it's more melodic, you know what I mean, than some jazz guitarists.
I think I always remember as a child, there was a guy that, the first person that introduced me to Wes, he kind of said, you know, have you heard Wes, first of all? And it was like, no. So he told me to come by the house and I've got something for you. So he lent me a Wes Montgomery record, which I took home and played. And I was like, wow, you know. And he just said, give it back when you finish with it, you know. And I spent quite a bit of time with it. And that was my introduction to Wes. And it was the sound of the guitar that got me, you know. I was hooked on the guitar firstly, and it was the clean sound of the guitar, meaning with no effects, no, you know, just a straight amp and a little bit of reverb. And it was just the sound Wes could get, you know, with it. And it was amazing that he just played with his thumb. So and he had, you know, he was, you know, he achieved things that people just couldn't imagine. And it's a way of playing that incorporated just so much harmony in the lines that he plays. You know, even if the chords weren't there, you'd still hear what the harmony was. And that's what Wes did for me. And then I listened to people like Grant Green and George Benson. And as I say, those are my three main influences, and mainly because I just like the way they can capture an audience. And, you know, I mean, there's other guys, Tal Farlow, you know, Barney Kessel. I listen to all the guitarists. They're all great players. But, there's Rodney Jones. He's a great player as well. So Bobby Broom, he's out there doing his thing today and he sounds great as well. So there's so many different players and they all bring something different to the table. But I am drawn to people that think, okay, let's do something with this or let's change that or, let's be a little bit accessible at least so that someone else can be hooked on that melody or whatever it is,
Mm-hmm. So do you have a good guitar collection or is there one main instrument you use?
I think I've got a collection. My approach was, I think I got three jazz boxes, but I've got a special Ovation. It's an Adamas Ovation that I bought in the States many years ago, that I use for acoustic things. And a little baby Martin, which sounds great plugged in, it's just a great sound, great tone. And then I've got a few kind of Strat kind of guitars and a Les Paul. I really like the Les Paul because that is so. But I use them for different things. So if it's not jazz, I'll be using one of the other guitars, which will give me what I need.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I like to have, I tend not to collect just for having sake, I like to to have a quality guitar that will give me a sound that I think, okay, I like that sound. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
So you went to Guildhall when you were younger.
Mm.
Do you have any memorable musical memories from that time?
Oh, the Guildhall was a journey. I think it was... my first journey into the world of, I guess, playing with a big band. And I remember mm-hmm. we were there and we played Ronnie Scott's for a week with, it was Randy Brecker. So there was two guitarists. So when one was on, the other one was off. And that was actually, in hindsight, the best thing because when I was off, sometimes Randy Breck could be in the dressing room, we'd be able to just have a chat. He probably wouldn't remember now, but I remember back then, it was just amazing to be around such a great musician.
He's a trumpet player.
Trumpet player, yes. Mm-hmm.
So Ronnie Scott's is such a legendary jazz club, so you were in the big room, I imagine.
That's right.
Yes.
So, I mean, clubs change over the years, and I think back then it was very different to how it is now. Mm-hmm. And it was a place where just musicians would gather, and we just go down and stand at the back and listen to different artists and whatever. Mm-hmm. But now it's like the New York scene. So you have one show, and then that audience leaves, and the second show starts.
Yeah.
So it's all changed. Yeah, all changed. Still a great place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I was in London last time, I was looking to hear some jazz. So we went there, but it was like the small room upstairs. And I forget who was playing downstairs, but it was one of the biggest names. It escapes me who it was. So then I happened upon a documentary about Ronnie Scott. So it was quite interesting about him and the club and how it got started.
I'll look into it. Yeah.
You might want to check that out. What's the jazz scene like in London? It's such a big city.
I think over the years it's changed. I remember when I first went down there, there were a lot of places to play, and I think over the years, I think there's just more musicians and less places to play, and especially after COVID, some places closed down, some places, new places are opening and such forth. But it's still a great place to play music, it's got a few great venues, and there's quite a lot of musicians around, music colleges and whatever else. So, it's a growing, there's lots of young musicians coming through as well. So, it's changing all the time.
I realized I kind of glossed over Guildhall. You said it was like this great experience, and you mentioned playing with Randy Brecker, but what else about that experience?
I think you were it's good to be around so many musicians that are all trying to do the same thing, but something different, if you know what I mean. So everyone's got different influences, and everyone's at a slightly different, everyone works at a slightly different pace. Some people like playing fast tunes, some people, and you got to fit in somehow, you know. So it's an introduction how to fit in and to, you know, even play music that's not really your thing. So, you know, you've got small band experiences, you've got even like duos, you've got everyone, like you say, everyone's got different tastes, and you know, so you have to be a bit versatile and open-minded. I think I learned that you have to approach every situation with an open mind, you know, and be willing to try new things.
Now, I'm curious, when you went to school to become a school teacher, was that just to have a solid backup plan?
That's a very good question. I think part of it was my father always stressed that, you know, having a good education was very important. So the honest truth is I really couldn't think of what I really, really wanted to do, apart from there was only two things that I really enjoyed. One was sport and one was music. And in between that was getting some form of education, or at least something that you could do. And the word in the house was, if you can do something, someone will want you. And if you can't, then nobody's going to want you. So we're all encouraged to do things. And so that's probably how I, you know, found myself in that space, you know.
And when you were spending more time teaching music, did the skills that you learned through that help you dealing with kids?
I didn't teach music though when I was teaching in school. It was just more general. So it was not difficult. It was an interesting time because it was almost like a transition time, because I would be working, but I'd be up really late at night trying to learn my instrument, etc. And the mornings would be terrible. You know, just getting up in the morning and having to get into work would be almost like a trial, you know, because you'd been up so late and you might have had 3 hours sleep or whatever it was. So I spent, you know, as little time as possible preparing for work, and as much time as possible doing what I enjoyed, which was music.
Yeah.
So I guess it wasn't fair for the kids.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just something you go through.
Now, actually, in terms of a musician's lifestyle, especially you're playing club, so you have to be up late most of the time. And you mentioned you love sports. So do you have, like, routines that help keep you healthy with all the, you know, it can be really hard on the body to be touring around and up late every night?
I think what it was with the sport thing, I just played a lot of sport at one time, and then for many years, and I had no routine at all. So it would just be, you know, whatever. And I think what sustained me in those years was the fact that I'd done so much prior to that, you know. But now I tend to try and make sure that, you know, I do some form of exercise every week, some kind of calendar. Just put it in the calendar so that there's at least two or three sessions, whether it's even just walking, you know, whether it's, you know, a little bit of nothing too heavy, but some little weight session or just a class that I might go to. And just trying, because I think sometimes you can be stuck in a position, you know, you hold the guitar and you're stuck in that position for a few hours, and if you don't get into the habit of I guess dealing with your posture, you know, you can end up with all kinds of aches and pains and, you know, back pain, you know, because everyone sits differently or stands differently when they've got something on their shoulders, and it's so easy to mm-hmm. not stand straight. And so I think it's really important to do something that kind of evens it all out, you know, and makes everything straight in one way or you know, because you're kind of off balance with a guitar. It's just how it is, because you've got this thing yeah. one side that, you know, and so you most people will be leaning one way or the other. So it's inevitable after a few years of that, if you don't look after whatever's going on, that there'll be some form of strain. And then the fingers as well. I know quite a lot of people that have had repetitive strains and whatever else. I think I've been fortunate, but mm-hmm. it's something that people don't really talk about in terms of how to stay fit, you know, in terms of musically fit and what to do with your limbs, your arms, your whatever it is that you use, you know. And it's one of those things, I guess, that should be part of, you know, a schedule, whether you're teaching guitar, whatever it is, you know, you if you go to the gym and you're going to do a class or whatever, they're going to go through warm-ups and all kinds of things. And I think very often we turn up at a gig and there's no preparation at all. You know, you just plug in and you start, you know, and I guess that's a recipe for disaster in the long term. So it's a discipline to get there early so you can do whatever preparation you need and go from there, really.
Mm. Yeah. And I think when people are young, they maybe take things for granted. And as you get older, you realize, like, I certainly find as I gotten older, I need to warm up more, much more than I did when I was younger. Mm. Like, my joints are stiffer, you know what I mean?
Yes. I think different instruments have their different challenges. And mm-hmm. I think being a guitarist, for me, the challenges, physical challenges, would be, you know, definitely your back because of the way you might stand or sit. And then it's just somehow you've got to keep your hands in shape somehow. You've got to keep, you know, you've got to do something with them to keep them supple. But also remember that you none of these positions are natural positions for our bodies, in my opinion anyway. Mm-hmm. It's not natural to stand with a guitar and whatever, twist your hands around it or whatever you want to do. So I think it is important to actually address it in some way, and everyone's different, so what works for me may be different for someone else. But I think to bear it in mind and just to realize that even though when you're younger it's a lot easier, but as time goes by, it's good to, once you start a habit, you know, of preparation or whatever it is, it's a good thing to keep it going, and hopefully gives you a few more years doing what you do, what you enjoy.
Yeah. I was reading some stuff on your website. You had good advice for students about singing along, you know, to internalize harmonies. And also, I think you were addressing a mistake people who start and then maybe get discouraged because they don't realize you need this long sustained effort, but it still has to feel fun. Yes. You know? So I was wondering if you could reflect on that, or if you had any advice for people starting out who want to play.
I think the thing about teaching a student is everyone develops in a different way, and sometimes people learn in different ways as well. So what works mm-hmm. for one student won't necessarily be the best approach for another. So some of it is getting into the mind of the student and understanding how they tick or how they turn, whatever helps them to develop. And it may be simple things. It might be that one person needs you to do, you know, maybe smaller phrases to teach them so they can sustain it. Another person might think that's too short for me. I need a longer phrase so that I can have it all in my head, and then I can, you know. And then the other thing is getting students, especially people who have just starting out, to realise that it is a bit of an unnatural thing to put your fingers on some strings that are closely put together, and it takes a bit of coordination, and it will come in time. So everything you do, you need to really slow it down, you know. And that's even for more advanced players. If you play things, you know, half the speed that you normally would, and make sure that they're right. Because I was always told that a mistake that is practiced becomes what you do, you know, and that's what you're going to end up with. So it's always a good idea to slow things down. Use the correct fingering, which you know, and then from there you've got a good basis to gradually speed things up. And the more you get into the habit of practicing something correctly, is the more that habit goes on for everything you learn, and everything else then just becomes natural. And then as you speed things up, it falls into place, as opposed to falling out of place, you know, because you practice something wrong, using the wrong fingering, all of a sudden you try and speed it up and you think you've got it, and all of a sudden it's like, I've got to start all over again, you know. So I think sometimes there are occasions where someone just plays in a totally, what we might think is a weird way of doing it, and it works totally for them. But I think for the majority of people, most things are quite uniform, and the way that our hands and bodies work is quite uniform. And so therefore, if you get into the habits that you're taught normally, you'll progress quicker. So I would just, for anyone starting out, or even for people who play a little and want to keep moving at a quicker pace, the first thing to realise is that sometimes slowing everything down will help you to get things right first of all, and then when you start speeding things up, it's more likely to fall into place, and your journey will probably be slightly quicker than having to relearn and do it again and again until you do it the correct way. So my advice is to slow down.
So, and you know, I was just thinking, you know, looking back, because you had a bit of a change in your life where you were trying to teach and do music, and then you've been able to just do music for your career. So looking back on young Edison, would you have anything to say to him?
I would probably say a bit more patience, instead of, because sometimes you can feel like you've got to go with a trend, you know, and you've got to follow the trend, and what everybody else is doing, you've got to do, because that's going to get you from A to B. And I would just suggest stick with the path that you are on, the one that you think you're going to enjoy, because I don't think anyone wants to play music they don't enjoy. So go on your path, and ignore, you know, when you're playing for other people, other artists and whatever, okay, be versatile and whatever else it is, but I think it's important to know where you want your journey to take you. So I would have said to a younger me, figure out where you want your journey to go, and then follow that journey and stick with it. Yeah.
Beautiful. So thanks so much for this today. Really enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for sharing your music as well.
Great, it's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please do share this with your friends, and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. The link is in the description. Have a wonderful week.